Morning to friends in Adama here. For those of you who are here in BGF for the first time, welcome. And I know a lot of you today here know Ajahn Brown very well. But for our new friends here, I would like to introduce Ajahn Brown proper for this morning. Yeah. So Ajahn Brown was born in London back in 1951. He regarded himself as a Buddhist at the age of 17. But his interest in Buddhism and meditation flourished while studying theoretical physics at Cambridge University. After completing his degree, Ajahn actually taught for 1 year before he travelled to Thailand to become a monk. He was ordained at the age of 23. He subsequently spent 9 years studying and training in the forest meditation tradition of the late Ajahn Chah. In 1983, Ajahn Brown was asked to assist in the establishment of a forest monastery in Perth, Western Australia. Ajahn Brown is currently the abbot of the Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine and the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, teaching and training monks and novice and lay people. A lot of us here in Malaysia has been fortunate to be able to hear talks from Ajahn Brown for the last several years. And I'm sure a lot of us too has the opportunity or had the privilege of the influence of Ajahn Brown to push the door of our heart to ourselves and also to those around us. Again this morning, Ajahn Brown will share with us for the whole day on the road to spiritual transformation. I believe all of us are eagerly waiting for this journey to the spiritual transformation. With that, I pass over to Ajahn Brown.
Very good. So you probably have worked out the structure for today. It's in three parts, and you've got first of all the transforming the action, then transforming the heart, then transforming the mind. And it's based on the threefold practice of Buddhism, of sila, samadhi, panya, of actually your precepts or your virtue, what you actually say and what you actually do, on training the mind in the meditation techniques, and following that. Can you hear okay? Can you hear in the back? If you can, put your hand up. Okay, if you can't hear upstairs, just bang on the floor. If you can hear, keep quiet. Don't bang too hard, otherwise you'll fall through. So, and the last of those practices is transforming the mind with wisdom. So it's like virtue, meditation and wisdom. And very often when I give talks here in Malaysia, except on retreats, that sometimes you give talks which are very useful but sometimes not so deep. So today I wanted to go a little bit deeper. Having given many talks with many stories today, I want to get a little bit deeper on how you can actually transform your virtue, how you can transform your mind, make it more peaceful, how you can transform wisdom, how you can have this triple practice of the Buddha. And this is actually the heart of the Buddha's teachings. It doesn't matter whether you follow this tradition or that tradition, because I often noticed that even in the Bodhisattva paths, which is supposed to be developing the six paramitas, or the six parami, for those six parami, what you're supposed to do, not why you're supposed to do it, but what you're supposed to do, is that it's to develop sila, samadhi, panya. That's half of the six paramitas. Virtue, meditation and wisdom, but also generosity, dana, akanti, which is forbearance, and virya, energy. So actually when you look at what you're supposed to do, it's exactly the same. So that these days I think, I don't care what you call yourself. Call yourself a Mahayana, Zen, Tibetan, Theravada. I prefer you that everyone just call themselves Buddhists and left it at that. And the point was, actually, what you're doing is important. So these practices, which I'm going to be talking about today, they apply across the board to all Buddhists, even to other people as well. It doesn't matter if you're not a Buddhist. It should be quite clear that these things are going to transform and enhance your life. But the first subject, which I wanted to talk about this morning, is virtue. And one of the important aspects of virtue, which I want to emphasize, is that virtue is nothing more than learning how to be happy and increasing one's happiness and also increasing other people's happiness. Because when you know what virtue truly means, and it was explained by the Buddha to his son Rahula in the Rahula Wada Sutta, it was a beautiful teaching because it gave you the essence of what virtue truly is. The virtue is much deeper than the five precepts. The five precepts just give a little framework for you to understand it in practical life. But at its heart, what virtue is not doing or saying, even thinking anything, which will harm another person. Not doing anything, saying anything, or thinking anything, which will harm yourself. So these days, you know what it's like, sometimes people are just so busy, and they say that we can't keep five precepts, it's too hard. So I say, well, if you can't keep five precepts, just keep two precepts. And those are not doing anything which harms another being, not doing anything which harms yourself. And I say that if you can keep those precepts, you are actually keeping all the precepts either of a lay person or even of a monk. Because that's the essence of virtue. Being harmless. And once you understand that as the essence, you can understand why we do have those precepts. Because why do you want to harm anybody? Why do you want to harm yourself? But unfortunately, sometimes because of delusion, stupidity, because of confusion, we do things which harm ourselves and harm others. We regret it afterwards. And so the Buddha gave the teachings on virtue to try and help people be harmless people instead of be kind people and not to harm anyone or any being in this life. So we have those precepts just as guidelines. But when we understand why we're keeping virtuous precepts, it's not to harm ourselves or not to harm others, it also makes it quite clear that people who keep precepts become happier people. Many years ago, I was teaching a retreat in Perth, and as I mentioned about our retreat centre, well, we always have to hire a Christian retreat centre because there's no Buddhist ones in Perth. We want to stop that and actually get our own one. But when we were holding this retreat, during the interview time, one person had gone out and I was waiting for the other person to come in. I looked out of the window. Because it was a Christian retreat center, there was a church next door and it was on a Sunday. And the Sunday service had just finished. And I saw these two men shaking hands to say goodbye to each other. They were friends. And their parting words were, be good. And the other one said, no, that's no fun. And I thought, my goodness, they've just come out of church. And already they're trying not to be good. And also they don't understand that actually being good is fun. If you want to have a good time, then be good. And this is something which I learned little by little. The world, many other people say, oh, go and take alcohol, take drugs, and you have a good time. And I certainly remember from my own experience as a student, I didn't start off as a Buddhist. As a student, I had some understanding of the theory of Buddhism, but I had no encouragement for precepts and other things. So I used to go out and get drunk, like all my other friends did. And I remember one occasion, it was actually the last time I ever took alcohol. And it was such an embarrassing thing afterwards when I thought what I was doing. But everyone else was doing this, and so I decided, you know, this is what you're supposed to do. I was like a sheep, just following others, not thinking out things for myself. This was at Cambridge, because in my college, I was a scholar there, because I had got a scholarship to get in. My family wouldn't be able to afford it otherwise. And that every year they had a scholars' dinner. The top 10% in the college of students would go to this dinner. And with these students, you'd have the lecturers and the professors. They would be there as well. And you'd actually, on the tables, you'd be always, you know, sitting next to a lecturer, and then a student, and then a lecturer, and then a student. And it was, we started off this dinner with having sherry in the gallery. This very beautiful cottage building, which was constructed by Sir Christopher Wren. Around a large mahogany table, there were butlers, in coat and tails, very highly trained, serving this wonderful sherry. Not cheap sherry, but very expensive sherry. Now at that time I was a student and very stupid. I was studying maths before I did physics. And I quickly worked out, I noticed those butlers were circling the tables in a clockwise direction. So I thought if I walked at the same speed in an anti-clockwise direction, I'd meet them twice rather than once every circuit, and thereby get twice as much sherry as everybody else. And I thought that was a clever thing to do, and I did it. And so even before we started the meal, I'd already had many glasses of sherry. When we started the meal in the main dining hall, again it was a 9-course meal. And with every course there was a different wine, with the butlers hovering behind you. Whenever your glass was more than half empty, they would suddenly appear out of nowhere and top it up again. Your glass was never empty. And after a 9-course meal with a different wine with every course, we went to the old library where there were cigars, cigarettes if you preferred, fruit, and 3 glasses, one for port, one for Madeira, one for claret, all different types of wine. Again, the butlers had instructions to keep them full all the time. And by that time, some of the lecturers were saying some very stupid things. And so was I. In the middle of this, there was a big goblet was passed down. I can't see anything to compare it with, maybe about 4 or 5 times the size of this cup. It's made of silver, encrusted with jewels. It was an heirloom of the college. It would be worth a fortune. And it was filled with claret, with this wine, to the brim. And every student and every lecturer, all the people in the college, had to drink that down and then say a toast in Latin. At the end of that evening, I don't remember the evening after a little while, because I was obviously terribly, terribly drunk, as everyone else was as well. But I woke up in the morning, I'd managed to find my way back to my lodgings, but I woke up in the morning, not just with a hangover, but on my pillow right in front of me was a big pile of vomit. I'd vomited up in my sleep. I heard later on that that is extremely dangerous. You can choke on that and die, and many people do die. And when I woke up to that sight, I was disgusted at myself. And I thought all that food which the servants in the college, the cooks and the chefs, had spent so much time cooking, and all the expense of all of that, it was now lying in front of me on my pillow. It had served me no good whatsoever. And I was so disgusted at myself that that was the last time I ever took any alcohol. I gave up there and then. I almost took it to an extreme. And I thought, why do people do this? It made no sense to me at all, taking alcohol or taking drugs. I couldn't see the point. And at that time, I wasn't a monk. I was still out with girlfriends, partying, going to dances. And I really thought, this is one of the stories, I really thought that once I gave up alcohol, that I would never be invited to any party ever again. Who wants to have some religious nutcase come into their party who can't enjoy themselves with other people? But actually, I found the opposite happened. I got invited to even more parties. And when I found out why, it was because they wanted somebody sober to drive them home afterwards, and that was me. And not only that, I could actually enjoy the parties. And I was a lay man, I was a boy dancing with girls, and so I could enjoy myself. And I never forgot what I was doing. I could actually get even more pleasure out of the party. And when I woke up in the morning, I was bright. And I realized that, my goodness, you don't need to have alcohol and drugs to enjoy yourself, even in the sensual world. In fact, if you don't, you have much, much more fun. It was actually telling me that you have more happiness when you keep precepts. And as I learned and investigated more and more, I found out, my goodness, why do you ever do silly things like argue with people or steal or take alcohol or drugs or lie? It doesn't make any sense to me anymore. It doesn't make any sense because it only harms yourself, it takes away your happiness, and it takes away other people's happiness. And so over the years, I became a virtuous young man. And after being a virtuous young man, I became a virtuous monk. And all the time, I've noticed that keeping my precepts, even as a monk, is not just to make my life more difficult, but actually makes my life happier and more fun. But I read this very early on from the sutras, where the Buddha says, there is a gradual path to enlightenment. And he said, one of the first rewards of your practice on the path to enlightenment is when you start keeping virtuous conduct. He said that a person who practices virtuous conduct experiences what he called the avayapajjasukha, the blameless happiness. This is the word of the Buddha mentioned many, many times. He said it's the nature of things that if you keep virtue, you are kind, you are gentle, you don't take alcohol and drugs, you don't hurt other people, you don't harm yourself, that you get an inner happiness. What it really means there, it means like as if on the sea the tide goes up. Sure that you have your highs and lows, you know, you have your peaks and your troughs, like in any surface of water, but you're so high that what is now your troughs, your low points, is even higher than the peaks you had years before. Your average level of happiness increases when you start keeping a virtuous lifestyle. And you can try that out for yourself. If you practice virtue, kindness, generosity, giving, being sensitive to other people, not harming them, not harming yourself, you'll see your average happiness level increases enormously. Which means that you won't get depressed. You won't get upset, you won't get angry. All the times you're getting angry and depressed get less and less, and there are only tiny little angers or tiny little depressions. Because depressions, what does it really mean? There's no happiness inside of you. Your life is dull and meaningless. If more people kept virtuous conduct, were kind, were generous, they'd get far more happiness in this life. And things like depression, grumpiness, anger would never come up in their minds. Simply because of the practice of virtue, it gives you more energy and makes you happier. So I always tell my visitors, if you want to see whether what we're teaching in this temple is worthwhile, don't just listen to the words, just see how it affects the people who come to the BGF or to my temple, my monastery in Perth. And if you find the people who come there are really miserable, are angry, get depressed, then please don't come. It's not worth it. But if you find that people keeping precepts are happier, more wonderful people to be around, then you know that something's happening and it's worth coming. What I'm saying here is the virtue, if it's done properly, will lead to your happiness. And not just to your happiness, will lead to the happiness of other people. People would like to be around you. Because we like to be around happy people, good people. You become very, very attractive. Which is why in the sutras the Buddha said, the beauty of a person is their virtuous conduct. Just like the scent of a flower would only go downwind, the scent, the fragrance of a virtuous person goes in all directions, said the Buddha. It's your fragrance, your beauty, is your virtue in Buddhism. Which is why I say when you come to a seminar like this, you're not just coming to the BGF, you're coming to Ajahn Brahm's beauty parlor. You are getting the cologne, the scent of virtue. Essence de Ajahn Brahm. But all these other people have got their own perfume. You get Elizabeth Taylor's scent. You get David Beckham's cologne. This is Ajahn Brahm's scent, which is virtue. For free, yeah. You're attractive. You're beautiful because you are virtuous. So there's many advantages of virtue, and this is one of the first things I want to emphasize, that virtue is not being miserable, it's not just doing these things so you can go to heaven when you die, it's you're doing it so you can go to heaven now. In this moment, you keep virtue just for the sake of happiness. Do it for that degree, that reason. And then you understand why we're being good people. So it makes sense to many people, and you can actually try it out to see if it works. But the difficult thing is how to be virtuous. I want to be virtuous, I want to be kind, but sometimes I just can't do it. And I really love my husband, but you know, always start, you know what husbands are like sometimes. I say these things, you feel rotten about it afterwards. So having emphasized the importance of virtue, of transforming your actions, how do you do it? And there is many beautiful techniques. First of all, realizing it's important, that it should be done, is reason number one. And number two is finding what we call in Buddhism the skillful means to transform your conduct. So mindfulness is important, because mindfulness, you see what you're doing, you see what's happening, and sometimes that just identifies the problems. It's like the doctor giving the first examination to find out what the symptoms are, and then he can actually find out the cause. But the most important thing in medicine is actually giving the appropriate remedy. And a lot of times, the reason why that we break our precepts or act unvirtuously is simply bad habits. It's just habits of the past which we find it difficult to break. Even though we know we should give these things up, sometimes we just can't do it. So how do you actually change your habits? There's a very powerful story which I think I mentioned, could have been in the Holiday Villa, which you may have heard before from the Jataka tales. Don't just think those Jataka tales of the Buddha are just for children. Some of them are just so deep, and they can be made use of by each one of us. Even I sometimes look at those Jataka tales and think, wow, that is deep, that is profound. And a particular Jataka tale I mentioned the other day, which is important to you, is the tale of the elephant. The king's elephant was usually a very docile, very easy elephant to work with. The rider or the elephant mahout would tell it what to do, and it would always do the right thing. It was a very wonderful elephant. Now remember, this was the days where kings would not have Mercedes-Benz or Rolls-Royces. The only way of travel was by elephant, so the kings would have the very best elephants. Sometimes the elephants were so long you called them stretch elephants. Like the current limos. But anyway, it did happen, just the elephant one day started getting grumpy and would not follow orders and started becoming aggressive. And first of all the mahout thought, oh, there must be something wrong with it, some sickness. But he tried to find out what was wrong with the elephant, but the elephant got worse and worse. And eventually it became such a big problem that they did not know what to do with this elephant. They couldn't see it was getting sick, it was eating well, but it was just so hard to work with and sometimes aggressive as well. And the king, trying to find out why this elephant had changed its character, asked everybody, and finally there was one of his ministers, which the Buddha said was him in a past life, said, leave it to me, I will find out why this elephant has changed his character from being someone who was docile and kind to someone who's aggressive and very, very hard to live with. And all the minister did, he went to the elephant store where the elephant stayed at night and just hung about there to see what was happening. And just after midnight, he heard a sound behind the elephant store. He very carefully went to investigate, and he saw that behind the elephant store, he noticed there was a gang of thieves. They were meeting there every evening to plan their robberies or their attacks on the village. And they would discuss what they were going to do, and they discussed what they'd done the night before. They'd drink alcohol, they'd talk to each other. And the minister realized why the elephant had changed his character. Even though the elephant could not understand the speech of human beings, still the elephant could understand, could feel the character of those people talking every night for many months, right next to where he slept. The minister realized the problem and knew what the solution was. The following morning he told the king and got some soldiers. They arrested all those thieves the following night. But that was not good enough. The minister then arranged for monks to go behind the elephant stall just where the thieves used to go and talk about Dhamma throughout the night, many, many nights in a row. And now the elephant, instead of actually hearing the bad speech of the thieves, started to hear the monks discuss Dhamma. Even though the elephant didn't understand exactly what they were saying, he knew it was kind speech, gentle speech. And in a few weeks, the elephant changed his character back to being this docile, kind, easy to work with elephant. You didn't even need to understand what was going on. You understood the mood, and that was enough to condition and affect the elephant. In exactly the same way, if you've got a husband or a wife or a child who's really hard to work with, who's grumpy, who's never follows instructions, or even aggressive, they don't even need to understand what I say. Just bring them in here, and after associating with good monks for a while, they will change their character just like the elephant did. In order to be virtuous, in order to be doing this, it's wonderful to associate with other virtuous people, to hang out with good people. Because if you associate with virtuous people, even if you don't understand why, you become virtuous yourself. There's a subconscious conditioning which happens, which is one really good reason to come to the temple. Just because when you come to temples or good churches or mosques or wherever, very often you are associating with good people, and it rubs off. Sometimes people would ask, when I first went to Thailand and went to stay with someone like Ajahn Chah, could Ajahn Chah speak English? And the answer was no. He couldn't speak a word of English, but I should actually amend that, because a couple of years before he stopped teaching because of a stroke. He went to visit England, and when he came back from England, he'd learnt one word of English, and only one word. You know what that word was? Cup of tea. He was such a funny monk to live with. And he said, I've learnt some English, he said in Thai. What word is that? Cup of tea, cup of tea, cup of tea. But many times people would ask him, Ajahn Chah, you can't speak any English. How come you got so many Western disciples? And this is how he used to answer. He said, look, teaching these foreigners, he said, it's just like in the fields when I was a farmer, just like training water buffalo. He said, all you need to do is you pull them this way, you push them that way, until they know what they're doing. So he called us water buffalo, and it's quite true. We learn most of it just by being around such a great person, by being around good monks. We were just like that elephant. Because sometimes you'd be hearing these great talks in Thai or Lao, we didn't understand what they meant, but we understand where they were coming from. And that changed our lives. Just association with good people helps you become more virtuous. So one way of transforming your actions is to have good friends, virtuous friends. Choose your friends wisely. Choose your partner in life wisely. And if you have a virtuous partner, a virtuous friends, virtuous parents, the chances are your virtue is going to be very, very strong. My own parents were very virtuous. That's why, one reason why it was easy for me to be virtuous. It's by attrition, how we actually rub off on each other. But if that does, well, that does work. I shouldn't say it doesn't work. That does work, but you can even go further than that by understanding some of the skillful means on how you can become more virtuous. By reflection, seeing the cause and effect. Now, if you lie, what's it like after you've lied? You feel terrible about you've lied, especially to a friend or someone you really care about. Which is why that sometimes that some of my disciples, you know, have thought they've lied to me and they can't sleep at night. They've got to come and say, Ajahn Bob, sorry. I say, come on, never mind. But they have to actually say sorry, because being unvirtuous, especially around other virtuous people, really, really hurts. So, see the consequences of not keeping virtue. You lose your happiness. You lose your even sense of self-esteem. It's one of the biggest problems in the Western world, and it's also a problem in Malaysia as well. Sometimes people have low self-esteem. They don't really think that they're worthy. They can do things. And because of that, they go to many psychologists to try and build up their esteem, to build up their confidence. And it's one of the results of keeping precepts. You realize you're a good person. You're a virtuous person. You're a trustworthy person. And that really increases your self-esteem enormously. It gives you more energy, more happiness. You feel good about yourself. Hey, I'm a good person. When you go to sleep at night, you look, what have I done today? I've go to the temple, I've given dana, I've kept precepts, I've listened to the Dhamma. Wow, I'm a good person. And then you get happy. We'll always be judging ourselves and judging our actions, so be careful to make sure your actions are judged in such a way, or the actions are such they can be judged in a good way to make you feel happy. So one of the great antidotes or remedies to lack of self-esteem is just being virtuous. Come on, be kind. Do something for others. Make them happy. And you'll feel good about yourself. You'll feel your life is worthwhile. You are a wonderful person, because you make other people happy. Years ago, when I was visiting England, I was on a retreat with this monk called Ajahn Sumedho. He's senior to me by about, I think 8 years, I think. And so he invited me to be his gapiya, you know, the monk, looking after him and being with him when those interviews. And so I went with him to this town in the north of Scotland, Oban, where there was a retreat being held for 9 days. So when it came to the interviews, I would sit there, and after a while I was getting really bored because people were asking the same old questions and I wasn't really paying attention. For those of you who are gapiyas who actually sit with the monks, sometimes you know what it's like. But this woman came into the room, and she said, I haven't come in here to ask any meditation questions. I've just come in here to thank you for saving my life. And the way she said it, I woke up. And I said, why are you saying this? What has this monk done? No, he hasn't dived in front of a car when you're just about to be hit by it and saved your life. He's not like Spider-Man or like Superman. He's just a monk man. Actually, you know that I've seen in the newspapers that they have all these movies about these superheroes. They've got Spider-Man, Superman, Catwoman, all these supposed to superheroes, which I used to read about when I was a kid. But there was one superhero they haven't made a movie out of yet. And if anybody knows anyone in that industry, here is a wonderful subject for a whole movie series. You can make heaps and heaps of money. Half of it will go to the BGF, half of it to my meditation center. Because I saw this when I was a young monk in the newspapers in Thailand. It was not Superman, it was not Catwoman, it was Super Monk. And Super Monk was in a series, this cartoon series, I saw in the newspapers, I think it was a Thai rat, I think it was. And this super monk would have all these psychic powers. Would be able to fly through the air and save people, or some evil person was doing something wrong and he just stopped them with his power. And in the end, he'd always give them some Dhamma. And, you know, give them the five precepts and give them this wonderful little teaching of the Buddha. And super monk would always, you know, save people from being beaten up, save people from being killed, save great disasters, save the tsunami. Super monk. Now, it's only fantasy, but it had a wonderful little storyline because it was actually teaching the Dhamma as well. So if anybody knows anybody in Hollywood, or even Bollywood, so see if you can do this new series of Super Monk. But the point of the story was that this Ajahn Sumedho was being super monk. He'd actually saved somebody's life. And I was really listening in now to find out what he'd done. And she told this story. This was not the first retreat at that retreat center. This monk, Ajahn Sumedho, had taught a retreat 12 months previously. And she'd come on that retreat. She told us that when she was a young student at university, she had some emotional problems, like with the study, with the pressure, with boyfriends. So she went to see the doctor, who sent her to a psychologist, who just very, very quickly had just prescribed Valium and told her to take this drug, which is addictive. After a very short time, she was addicted to Valium. But she never really knew exactly what it was doing to her, because if you take this drug, it's like you're living in a cloud. You're not fully alive. But when she came on this retreat, she heard that on a retreat you have to keep the 8 precepts. And when she heard the 5th precept, you're not supposed to take alcohol and drugs, she misunderstood. Because what we mean by that precept is not to take non-medicinal drugs. If you're on, say, insulin because you're a diabetic, or you've got other drugs you have to take because of your heart condition, you're supposed to take those drugs on a retreat. That's not breaking the 8 precepts. 8 precepts means not taking things like marijuana or heroin or those sorts of drugs. But she misunderstood. She thought, oh, I can't take my Valium. So she stopped taking it for those 9 days. It was difficult for her, but because it was a retreat situation when she was living with such wonderful people, kind people, there was noble silence, there was hardly any stress at all, she could handle that. It wasn't that hard. When it came to the end of the retreat, she thought, I've given up that Valium for 9 days, let's see if I can keep up not taking it. The trouble was, living in a retreat center in a remote town on the northwest of Scotland is very, very different than actually living in the so-called real world. She had to get a bus from Oban to Glasgow, go to the station and catch a train home. In a huge city, in a busy station, she said she almost went out of her mind. She hadn't taken that Valium for 9 days, and now she had to endure the stress of going to a huge station, finding her train and getting on it. But she said she managed. She got back home and she spent the next 3 months, the only thing she could do was sit in a chair. She couldn't do anything while the effect of that drug wore off. She said what kept her going was little teachings such as this too will pass. What kept her going was realizing it's impermanent, these feelings I'm experiencing now, they will wear out. What kept her going was mindfulness. And she said after about 3 months, she was finally free of that addiction. And she said it was like walking out of a mist. She could feel, she could see the beauty in the flowers, she could like hear the sound of her partner, she could feel again, she was alive again. So when she came into this room, she said to this monk, thank you for saving my life. She hadn't really been dead. She'd been half dead, in the stupor, in the mist, in the clouds of that drug. And this little monk had taken her out of that prison, released her and given her life back. That's why she came and said, thank you. And that's why I tell that story now. I remembered that, and I remembered how I felt at the time, and I feel the same again. Wow, if I can only do that just to one person. I told myself at the time, if in all my years as a monk, if I can just help one person, if one person comes out to me and says, Ajahn Brahm, thank you for saving my life, then my whole monk's life would have been worthwhile. Fortunately, that event, the first person who came to tell me, happened many years ago. Many people have come since to say, thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for saving my life. Imagine how that feels to have really helped other people. Not by teachings, just by example. That's what Ajahn Sumedho did, just by example. Imagine his self-esteem. Imagine my self-esteem. Imagine how you feel inside of yourself. Because of your goodness, you've helped other people out of suffering, out of pain, out of the prison of like drug addiction. Imagine how you feel. That's what I mean about the happiness which you get from keeping precepts, from affecting other people, by taking people out of the pain and suffering of life. Wow, you really get so much happiness. Virtue has an instant reward. It's good karma. So you get happiness back immediately. Now, there are times when I've seen great acts of generosity, and they make me cry. There's one occasion, one of the best acts of generosity I've seen. There was one of my disciples, was a Laotian girl. After the Vietnam War, the family had fled across the Mekong River, had got into the refugee camp just by Nong Khai in the north of Thailand. Staying there for many years, the family were eventually settled in Western countries. Because of some mistake by the bureaucracy, she was settled in Western Australia. Her mother, father and brothers were all settled in Oregon in the US. They split the family apart. You know how that must feel. But there's no choice, you can't argue, you're a refugee. She got on a plane, she didn't know where she was going. Her parents went on another plane with the rest of her family. When she arrived at the destination, she found she was in Western Australia. She discovered her family were on the other side of the world, in the west of the United States. She couldn't do anything about it. So she managed to try and build a life for herself. But in this particular time, she came to see me in our temple in Perth, crying her eyes out. She was just beside herself with grief. She just got a message from her brother in Oregon that her mother was ill, very ill, would probably die within a few days. The brother asked her to come back and see her mother. The reason why she was crying, she was a refugee. She didn't have the money for the airfare. She was staying in rented accommodation. She was just had enough to just buy her food every week with some support from the government and no more. And the ticket to the US from Perth, especially at such short notice, cost a lot of money. And this is why she was crying. She hadn't got the money. She had to see her mother. She was dying. And as I was trying to console her, there was another woman standing behind who was a Thai. She too had come for some counselling because she had been a nurse. She had injured her back while being a nurse. She tried to get some sort of compensation or some pension, but the government and the other nurses had accused her of faking the injury. So she was without a job, in pain, coming to see me for counselling. She stayed in a house which was a government house, subsidised by the government. She too was very poor. But I saw this Thai nurse, when she heard this Laotian girl's problem, silently reach for her handbag, take out her checkbook, and write a blank check without the name for $2,000 and just give it to this Lao lady. She couldn't afford that. That was a lot of money for that nurse who was out of a job. She couldn't afford it. But who cares? She couldn't afford not to give. And the two of them ended up crying, and I almost cried as well. They hardly knew each other. But who cares? Someone needed help, and they gave that help. And of course, every time I think and remember that, that gives me happiness. My own story was when I was a student. Going to the Buddhist center one day, someone came and gave a talk, not about Dhamma, but about the orphanage they were running in Nepal somewhere. And I think it was in Sikkim. An orphanage there for kids who hadn't got any parents. And when I heard what she was saying, I was so inspired and impressed. The following morning I went to my bank and got out, £10. You may not think that's very much, as in 1970, I think. But for me, as a student, that was 2 weeks' food money. That hurt me, physically. I didn't starve, but I didn't have much food those 2 weeks. And I just got the check and sent it off to this orphanage. That was the best £10 I've ever spent in my life. Every time, even now, when I think what I did, and just that money went to feed a few kids who didn't have anything, that gives me so much joy. Like, it's an investment. It happens. And every time you remember that, you get happy. The point I'm saying here is you transform your actions because it gives you happiness, it gives you joy, and it inspires other people. In your life of being a monk, you see so many happy things occur with virtue when you transform the action. And when you be around other people who are like that, you get into that yourself, and it becomes this wonderful, joyful act of giving. Sometimes people fight, what can I give to you? You know what it's like when there's dana? People bring their food, I say, please eat mine, Ajahn Brahm, please eat mine, please. No, eat mine, so I usually have to eat the lot, that's why I put on weight. It's not my fault, it's your fault. And isn't it wonderful actually joining in these wonderful virtuous acts of kindness, selflessness, generosity, being a good person. And when you hang around that, even if you don't participate yourself, you just hang around, just like the elephant, you get into this beautiful high and happiness of goodness, of virtue. There's one other very beautiful and very successful, skillful means I've been teaching many people over the last few years. And I mention this because somebody asked me this last night, and I told them this is what you should do, because they had a person in their life and they couldn't help themselves. Every time they meet them, they get angry at them. It's the bad habits we sometimes get. And it sometimes happens in your marriage, in your partnership. Sometimes you get into bad habits, the way you speak to your husband or the way you relate to your wife. And because it's a habit built up because of unskillful or lack of mindfulness over many days, many years, it's not that easy to stop. But there is a way, and a very effective way, which I call programming mindfulness. I call it programming mindfulness because I use the language of computing and use like mindfulness as actually, you know, your software. And what I really mean is that you reprogram your habitual responses. And how you do that, suppose that, you know, you're in this habit of like speaking heedlessly or sort of cruelly to your husband. You know, little jibes, things which you think are only fun, but which really hurt him. What you should do is actually in the quietness, or in some quiet moments, in time when you're by yourself, you think of your husband, this is just the example, and you tell yourself, the next time I see my husband, I will not say something cruel, but something nice. The next time I see my husband, I will not say something cruel, but something nice. The next time I see my husband, I will not say something cruel, but something nice. You repeat that to yourself 3 times, as mindfully, as carefully as you possibly can. And then you forget about it. Sometimes you have to do that several times before it really works. But what happens is that sometime later you see your husband and the old habit is about to start, you know, say, oh, you're late again. And instead of saying that, a thought comes in the mind which says, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to say something nice instead. And you actually start saying something nice. You change your habits by reprogramming your mind. And that's how you do it. And it's not that hard to do, and it's incredibly effective. What you have to do is, when you're feeling calm, when you're feeling peaceful, when the problem is not right in front of you, tell yourself what you want to do next time that trigger, that person is in front of you. And tell yourself what to do very carefully 3 times. And when you're in that situation the next time, that program will kick in. and it will change your habits. You even use that with smokers. If someone wants to give up smoking, it's not when they've got the cigarette in their hand. They tell themselves in some quiet moment, peaceful moment, next time I want a cigarette, I will have a cup of tea. Next time I have a cigarette, I will have a cup of tea. Instead. Next time I want a cigarette, I'll have a cup of tea. Whatever it is, you can change the instructions. But what will happen then, they get the urge, I want a cigarette. And that memory will come up straight away and say, no, I'll have a cup of tea instead. It will actually change the habits of your mind. It will change the conditioned flow of your mind. And it actually can change some of those bad habits of actually speaking hard words to other people. It can even change your own bad habits of being cruel to yourself. Our mind is a conditioned phenomena. The Buddha mentioned this many, many times. It runs by cause and effect. Because it does run by cause and effect, it's a conditioned thing. When we understand that, we can recondition it very easily. We put in different instructions. And if you do that, it's amazing just how you can actually change the way you speak, the way you act. You can actually change old habits pretty quickly. Sometimes people have to go to a hypnotist to actually to get such information. But in Buddhism we know all about the mind. You can actually hear this in the BTF, but no charge whatsoever. And it's much easier. Once you get the hang of this, you can actually recondition yourself to be a different person. And it's not hard at all. When the problem is not in front of you, identify the problem, decide your much better response, say that to yourself 3 times, listen carefully, and then forget about it. And it happens. If you want to play around with this, and I use this little method just to show you how powerful conditioning can be. Tonight when you go to bed, I don't know what time you have to get up tomorrow morning, but say it's 6 o'clock in the morning. Set your alarm clock to 6:05, just in case, so you're not worried. And tell yourself, as you're going to sleep, I will wake up at 6 a.m. I will wake up at 6 a.m. I will wake up at 6 a.m. And then forget about it. And just go to sleep. You will be surprised how many of you will open your eyes. What time is it? Look at your clock. And it will be 1 or 2 minutes either side of 6 a.m. without any alarm clock at all. This is actually how the mind is open to conditioning. If only you knew how you can do this. You wouldn't even have to have a diary. This is sometimes what I do. I'm sometimes very busy. I have to call someone at 3 p.m. I don't need to put it down. I just need to tell myself, at 3 p.m. you must call. At 3 p.m. you must call. At 3 p.m. you must call. I forget about it. And then just before 3 p.m. the thought comes up, oh, I must call so-and-so. It happens all the time. It's so reliable that you don't have to worry about things anymore. You just program the information in and you know it's going to come out at the right time. Isn't that a wonderful, efficient, quiet way to live your life? You don't have to worry anymore. Just put the instructions in and you know it's going to work. It's almost like you have this, you know, sometimes you have you can ring up the telephone company and they will actually give you reminder calls or give you SMS messages. You don't need it anymore. You've got your own SMS reminder calls inside here. But why use that, especially to enhance people's precepts? Because it's many times we do bad things just because of habit, that's all. We've been doing it for such a long time, we don't know how to stop. Now you know how to stop. You can actually transform your actions, transform your speech, even transform the way you think. For some of you who are married or about to get married and you're still subject to lust, and you see this other girl over there, this other boy, I really like her, she's really nice, she's really hot. But, you know, you're married, you've got commitment. How do you stop that? Sometimes if you're heedless, you can get lost very easily and end up with adultery before you know what you're doing. If that is your problem, program your mindfulness. If you're a boy, you say, next time I see a really attractive girl, I remember I'm married. Next time I see an attractive girl, I remember I've married. next time I see an attractive girl, I'll remember I'm married. You program that into yourself. And what happens is you're walking down the street, you see someone attractive, oh, I'm married, I better not even look any further, I've got a wife. You can actually train yourself in that way. Recondition your mind to protect your virtue. And when you protect your virtue, you'll be a happier person. When you're a happier person, you'll be a greater inspiration to other people, and your happiness will spread like a wave. So that's actually how we can transform our actions. I've already spoken too long, because I want to give time for questions. So for the next 25 minutes, are there any questions on transforming your actions by being kinder, more skillful in body, speech and mind? If anyone is scared of asking questions, during lunch hour, sit in a little corner there and tell yourself, I will not be afraid of asking questions. I will not be afraid of asking questions. Change yourself. It works. It's incredible how it works. Yes, thank you. That's very good. That's a very smart and very clever and very wise question. You say to do good is easy, but to be good is difficult. Because sometimes that we can do good, especially in front of other people, and I've noticed this, that some people are just so kind when they're in front of monks. But when they go home, oh, they're so cruel to their husband, or they're so mean to their wife. Or they may be good with their family, they go to the office, and oh, they're just terrible in the office. So sometimes we start by doing good, and we build it up until it becomes such an important part of our lives that we are good. We become really good people. So we start by doing good, by acting it out. But eventually we find that the heart of all goodness is actually selflessness. So we're not actually doing it anymore. It's not actually me doing goodness, it's just what happens. Because when you don't think of yourself, when you're thinking of other people, when you're married you don't think of me, you think of us. When you're working for, say, the BGF, you're thinking not of me in my position, what I want to get out of this, you're thinking of what I can give. It's the community which is important, not me. When as a monk you think it's the Dhamma is important, not me, or not my monastery or my temple, but Dhamma, Buddhism. When you become more selfless, you naturally become good. That's why later on this afternoon, when I start to get into wisdom, see, the root of all evil, as it were, is our sense of ego and a sense of me and mine. Later on, as you become more wise, virtue, goodness, becomes natural. You can't stop being good. Simply because the cause, the selfishness, concern about me, what I need, what I want, what I have to have, all disappears. And that's when you actually, goodness is. But what you say is true. It's not that you are good. Just goodness is. You aren't anything. You disappear. All being is stopped. Only goodness remains, just like a Buddha. Sometimes people are like that. Sometimes they're do-gooders. And they just do it because of pride, because of egotistical ideas. Sometimes they like to give a donation in coins. You know why people like giving coins? Because they can actually hear it when they're giving a donation. Now, if they give it like a check or like a banknote, you can't hear that. It's like you're not giving anything at all. No one knows. So the point of the matter is, it's wonderful actually to give sometimes donations or charity when nobody knows who's doing it. And I know some people like that. They're incredibly generous, but you wouldn't know who it is. Remember our nuns' monastery in Serpentine? It started off just as like a dream, like many great projects, and I think we had about $10,000 in the bank, and this was like many hundreds of thousands of dollars project. And one day I was told that they had a friend who wanted to give a donation to our nuns' monastery. Oh, very, very good. He said about $250,000. Well, that's very good. And then when they actually told me why, it was a person, they just had their first child, which happened to be a daughter. And he, when it was his first child in his family, he said, I really want to do something to celebrate that I've got a child. And he was a Buddhist, and he heard we were building a nuns' monastery, and he said, what a wonderful gift this will be, because who knows, maybe my daughter, when she grows up, will like to be a nun. And I could actually help make a place for my daughter. And so he came to my monastery, and you couldn't actually believe this was a rich man, because he had jeans and an old shirt. He didn't look or act like a rich man at all. He just read out the check and gave it to me. And I thought, it was so wonderful. He never actually wanted any recognition. He just wanted to give, that's all. And when I see such acts of selfless generosity, I realize that is a good person. They don't do good. It's not doing. He doesn't give this check in a big ceremony. He just, you know, comes some little time. Here you go. Thanks very much. Other times, I remember this one Sri Lankan man came. He came to me and said, look, I've been coming a long time. I want to give a big donation to our monastery. And he said, I want to know how to do it. And I said, oh, you know, you can come any time. He said, no, and it's a big one, so I really want to do it properly. And I think it was at $30. Not so it was big for him. But the point was, you know, he wanted some recognition. You know, he was someone who was doing good. He wasn't being good. Do you understand the difference? Is that what you meant as well? It's a very good, because you don't do it. It's not coming from ego. You're not sort of building up your goodness in some sort of league of goodness, like some Premier League table. You know, it's just actually doing good for the sake of being good, of just giving, of being kind. Okay, you've got some questions here from upstairs. Thank you, all those in the heavenly realms. Here we go. If I dislike a person very much, how should I program my mind? Okay, you may dislike a person very much because the simile of the brick wall in my book, you can only see their faults. If you dislike a person very much, see if you can investigate if they have any children, if they have a husband or wife, if they have anybody who loves them. Mr. Bush dislikes Mr. Bin Laden very much. But it may become as a surprise to Mr. Bush that some people, like his wife, his children, love him so much. And how can anybody love such a person? He's a killer, he's a destroyer, he's a madman. You might look at just that part of a person's character, but if you look at other parts of their character, you'll find there's other bricks in the wall of every human being. There's no person I've ever met who's all bad. They've always got some beautiful, good, lovable, kind parts in them. If you dislike someone very, very much, you should deliberately look for some redeeming qualities in them, to find out why other people can love such a person, to see what they see in him or her. Once you start seeing a person's good qualities, you start seeing the other bricks in their world, in their wall, the other parts of their character, not just the hateful things, but the nice, kind, gentle things. A strange transformation happens. You realize, hey, they're not just evil and bad or terrible. They have some nice qualities in them. Number one, you stop disliking them very, very much. You see, they are just like you. Good qualities and bad qualities. But what happens next is when you stop focusing on their bad qualities, the things you dislike, you start focusing on their good qualities, the part of them you can appreciate and respect. What happens is those good qualities start to grow. If you look at a person and look at their faults, those are what they will show you more and more. If you look at a person's good qualities, they will show you those more and more. What you look for is what you get. And when you look for the good qualities in a person, they start showing them to you at the same time they show them to themselves. This was my basic strategy when I used to work with prisoners. These were rapists and killers, people had done some mean and terrible crimes. But as I started to look at their good qualities, they showed me those good qualities. And they saw they had the good qualities themselves. They reformed. They became wonderful people, positive people who could contribute to society and can, you know, get married and have wonderful families. Like one of those stories is a couple of my students were drug dealers. And you know what happens when you deal in drugs? You're dealing in death. You know, you're selling drugs to kids, heroin, getting them addicted, ruining their lives. It's a terrible thing to do. But this is what we did with a couple of the drug dealers in the prison. First of all, give them a sense that there's more to their life than the drugs which they dealt. And on this one occasion, it was a local primary school, a grade school, was wanting to actually do some program for their children, the 10-year-olds, to try and stop them getting into drugs, because there's a great danger in many schools in the world. So first of all, the teachers thought, let's get some experts, some professor of psychology from the university or from the Department of Health. But this one amazing teacher thought, no, they're just all in their head, it's all theory. So teach our children the dangers of drugs, why not get a couple of prisoners from the local jail who know what it's like to take drugs, deal in drugs and get caught. So they invited two of my students from jail to spend a day in a primary school with 10-year-old kids to teach them what drugs do. What a brilliant idea that was, because who knows better than the ones who have actually been there and done it and hurt terribly because of what they've done. So these two of my students spent a whole day in a primary school telling not just some kids but as many kids as they could what happens when you start getting involved in drugs, how you start, what happens next, and what happens when you get caught, and what you feel like inside when you wake up in the morning in jail knowing you're there because you destroyed the lives of so many other people. They went there and said that to those kids. And the next time I visited there, one of my students, Nick his name, was dragged me by the arm, come and over here and look at this, Brum. Because the day after, in their art class, the teacher said, let's make some cards for those two prisoners to say thank you. And they had all these cards on the wall from the children. Thanks, Nick, for coming here and telling us what happens when we take. I will never take drugs. Thank you, Nick. I hope you get out soon. When you get parole, please come and visit us again. We all love you, Nick. And this hardened prisoner, he was just weeping in front of that board. He was crying his eyes out. It was the best thing ever happened to him. He'd done something to help other people not follow that same path. He saw something good in himself. And the kids saw that. When he was released, he never reoffended. The last time I saw him, I was at the airport in Perth. I was waiting for somebody. When somebody put their hand on my shoulder, I turned around and it was Nick. He gave me this big smile. He was in a very nice suit. He's obviously doing quite well. He said, hi, Bram. The thing he said, I'm still meditating. I meditate every day, he said. That was a drug dealer reformed. And how did he do that? I saw something, or not perhaps me, the teacher saw something good in this terrible person. When they saw something good, he saw something good. He cried. He never did drugs again. So if there's someone you really, really dislike, see something beautiful in them, and they'll see something beautiful in themselves, and the problem is solved. So see something good in them, and then you can like them. You can program your mind to like them. Only when you see something good, first of all. Can a person transform him or herself into a better, friendly, caring person if he or she is suffering? We don't always suffer. We have good days. We have bad days. So if it's only a good day, that's when you say to yourself, the cause of my suffering, because I think this or I do that, what is it? Then start programming your mind on your good days. And then the bad days don't seem to last so long. You're not always suffering. Or sometimes it might be an intense suffering, but one day it's not quite as much suffering as it was yesterday. And that's the day you can really act. But you can transform yourself, because you know, if you are suffering, actually you really need it. You have that friendliness and care inside of you already. Sometimes you've lost it. You can't find it again. It's in there. You know, like you lost your keys. They're in the house somewhere. They can't be anywhere else. Your friendliness and your care, it's in there. I've seen some really tough prisoners. Some monsters. And I've never seen anybody in my life who's all bad. They've always got this incredibly soft, caring center inside of them. I remember this story once of this Zen monk. He was going with his disciple. The disciple wrote his biography. And they were going to visit somebody who was dying of cancer in this apartment block. And when they actually went in the lift, there was these two like Hell's Angels. These two huge bikies. They had knives or whatever. They were really aggressive. They were obviously going to actually to have a drug deal or beat somebody up. And of course the disciple was really scared of these two monsters. But this Zen monk, you know, in his robes, you know, just a prime object for their venom, just asking to be beaten up, according to his disciple, started talking to them. Hi, how are you going? Good morning. He said, don't talk to them, avoid them. But his master, which is so kind and gentle, were these two hooligans, these two vandals, these two violent men, that by the time they got up to the sixth floor or whatever, that they shook hands, hi, goodbye, have a really wonderful day, you know, sadhu to them, whatever. And he realized that, you know, even these violent men sort of had this really soft side inside. And this Zen monk had seen that, had pressed that button, and they were just so kind to him. Even like gangsters sometimes, if you're kind to them, it's amazing just they look after you. And I felt the safest person in the whole of the prisons I used to visit, because I knew there's many prisoners there really cared for me. And they cared for me because I cared for them. And I knew that I would never get hurt in those jails with those violent people, because people cared, and I cared for them. So the person, if you care for yourself, then you will care for you back. So, how you can transform yourself into a better, friendly, caring person if you're suffering, try that. The door of my heart's open to me. Even if I'm suffering, that's okay. I can still love myself, even though I'm in pain. How can one use this transformation of action to help others who have bad habits? Okay, you have to start with yourself first of all. And you're going to be like those monks sitting next to the elephant stall and talking Dhamma. You will by nature. If you're a kind, caring, peaceful person, then you will transform other people's bad habits. That's how it works. So sometimes it's just attrition. It just rubs off on you. You're around good, kind people. You become good and kind. So you try it yourself first of all. You become this really wonderful, soft, kind, loving wife. You change your husband. You become, oh, you know, she's just kind, loving, beautiful person. I better be kind, loving, beautiful. And it works through attrition. So that's how you help other people with bad habits. And after a while they sometimes say, can you help me? Because they realize that, you know, they're sometimes mean to you. And they say, I don't want to be mean to you, I just can't help it. How can I help it? And you can maybe try programming your mindfulness. Or say, why don't you hang around good people instead of hanging around horrible people? Come to the temple or go to the church, wherever there's kind people, go there. And you'll find you'll change. So that's one way you can actually help other people with their bad habits. So actually this question arises when you told us yesterday that he died because he was born. My question is, how can we prepare for death? Not so much of going to heaven, but more than that, where we can be sure that we are ready to die. This afternoon, I'm going to tell you that meditation is a training in dying. Because what happens when you die? You let go of the body, you let go of all your possessions, you let go of all your family. That's what death is, isn't it? Letting go. So when we meditate, we're training in letting go. Actually, the whole Buddhist path is a training in dying. One of the first things you have to let go of when you die is your wealth. That's why we have donations. You're training how to let go. That's why in Perth we don't have donation boxes. We don't call them donation boxes. We call them letting go boxes. Training how to die boxes. You can't take it with you, you might as well put it in the box now.